Clean Simple Eats is a rapidly growing health and wellness company committed to elevating lives through food, fitness, and the best tasting supplements on the planet. The brand takes pride in offering clean, all-natural ingredients with zero artificial flavors and sweeteners. From their TikTok viral protein powders to their delicious super greens mixes and other supplements, every product is non-GMO, third-party tested, and comes in a variety of drool-worthy flavors. Fuel your body and transform your life. Shop Clean Simple Eats supplements.
You're listening to the Utah Checkdown Podcast. And now your hosts, Josh Furlong and Josh Newman.
Welcome back to another edition of the Utah Checkdown Podcast. I am Josh Furlong, joined as always with co-host Josh Newman. Josh, we just got back from Seattle. Beautiful Seattle, by the way. Beautiful. Yes. And I'm exhausted already. Like, I'm to that point of the season where it's just kind of like, I love football still, so I want to keep watching it, but I'm also just like, can we be done yet? I don't know. How do you feel at this point?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's definitely a little bit of fatigue, you know, once you get to this point in the season. And that's like, you know, regardless of whether or not like Utah is still in the Pac-12 championship mix or not, obviously they're not after the loss to Washington, but like, it's such a long season, and you're talking about like starting in, you know, really like mid, late July with Pac-12 media days, and that rolls into camp, and camp is kind of its own sort of grind. And within camp, you have this like real big ramp up to the opener, and that gets kind of exasperated in Utah's case, where the opener was Florida, right? This high profile thing. And each season is unique in like different storylines and things happening. The Cam Rising thing took up a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of energy. And that bled into like, okay, the month of September is a mess with the offense. And it's just one thing after the other, after the other. I was talking to, I think I might've said this to you or Steve Bartle or somebody, the last two seasons, 21 and 22 felt, at least to me, felt like real slogs. Like we were stuck in mud and it was just like never going to end. This season, for some reason, is going by very quickly to me. Like we're up to game 11 coming up. I don't know where that time went. So, again, each season is unique, positives, negatives from a media standpoint, peaks and valleys. I think we're all tired. I'm not saying like I'm hoping that the season ends.
No.
I'm just saying at this point, I think we're all pretty exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're seeing that in the players too. I think this was the first week, and it slowly creeps up each year, but this is the first week where you kind of got to the week where the players, they're done talking, right? Like they've said as much as they can say a million times. And quite honestly, there's some questions that these players get asked that are kind of asinine and kind of, I feel
no
for
name.
Them. Yeah.
No
we're not going to name names, but
no names.
I mean, I think, and this isn't a Utah specific thing. This is all across the country. I mean, you go to some of these bowl games and you hear some of these media and you're like, what is going on? But anyways, like it's just to that point of the season. It you have to dig deep to kind of really get into it and really want to keep going. Now these guys obviously want to play their games and that's what drives them. But I mean that, you know, it's real for everybody, right? Like I think especially now that Utah is out of contention for the Pac-12 championship, the first time in five seasons, at least meaningful seasons. We're not going to count COVID season. You know, that Utah's not relevant here at this point. I mean, they were relevant up to last week, and that's pretty crazy to be able to be that. And
Which is sort of remarkable based on all the problems and all the injuries.
Exactly.
But, I mean, that's a topic for later. But, you know, the fact that they were playing meaningful football on November 11th is kind of remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think if you look back at it, like before we did the, you know, when we started the season previews and stuff like that, if you would have said Cam Rising doesn't play this whole season, Brant Keithy doesn't play the whole season, and all these other season-ending injuries, and Utah still has a chance to potentially win 10 games this year, you know, that's pretty remarkable. So, I mean, take it all in with perspective. I mean, I know it's tough, but we're to that point of the season, so it'll be interesting. We'll break down a bunch of that other stuff too. So, but real quick, let's not spend a ton of time on this because nobody really cares, honestly. Let's be real. No, I'm just kidding. Pac-12 rewind. Let's look back at the week. You know, there really wasn't a ton of meaningful games outside of, obviously, Utah-Washington. That was a meaningful game. USC Oregon was probably the next biggest, and if not, probably the only one that really had a lot of substance. Yeah. You know, Oregon goes and gets a win 36-27, but it really just kind of felt like initially Oregon was dominating that game, right? Like USC couldn't do anything to stop them, as usual, right, with their defense. And then it's just kind of like Oregon just kind of like stopped in a lot of ways. They just kind of like got a little, I don't want to say careless, but they got a little less aggressive, and you could tell that they took their foot off the gas a little bit. USC kind of comes back. There was never really in doubt. I mean, anybody that watched that game realized that Oregon was going to win that hands down. Yeah. But, you know, there was moments where you're like, okay, like, is this going to be something or what? But I don't know. From your perspective, what did you see? And was there anything from that game or any other games that you're kind of looking at moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, there was never a moment. I think I watched that entire Oregon-USC game. There was never a moment there where you were like, Oregon is going to lose this game. I thought they stopped being aggressive. I thought they stopped going downhill a bit. And look, USC's offense is still prolific. Okay. And you still have the Heisman Trophy winner and you've got, you know, guys on the outside, but you just never got a sense that Oregon was going to lose full control of this thing. And I still, you know, I think we both probably watch an inordinate amount of Pac-12 football just because we're in this part of the country, we're covering the league, we're covering, you know, one of the teams. So I've seen enough of Oregon and Washington. Still think Oregon is the most balanced, you know, most capable team in the Pac-12 in terms of getting to a college football playoff. Oregon's tough. And they're going to keep being tough, and they have an older quarterback, and Bucky Irving can bash you over the head, and there's enough defense there. So, you know, just looking at some of the scores and just, you know, considering what we watched on Saturday, you take out the Oregon-USC game, I think Oregon State is the clear number three team in the league, mm-hmm. you know, putting up 62 on Stanford. They've just been very, very good, very, very steady. If they hadn't lost to Washington State early this season, we might be looking at this Oregon State team a bit differently. But look, they've got a colossal game in Corvallis on Saturday against Washington. You know, Oregon State needs that game in terms of, you know, keeping hopes alive to get to Vegas, to get to the Pac-12 championship game. So there's that. And then, you know, what else? I mean, we could touch on all these real quick. You know, Arizona continues to look very good, mm-hmm. right? With Noah Fifita at quarterback. Fifita has been a revelation. If you're asking me right now with two games to go, I think Jed Fish is Pac-12 Coach of the Year just for what they've looked like. Arizona State, a week after giving up 55 to Utah, kind of got back to business, and they made UCLA look very bad,
in winning
that game 17-7. Arizona State is 3-7 overall. That needs some context. They've been, you know, beset by injuries, especially on the offensive side of the ball, but their defense, save for that Utah game where they got trucked, Arizona State's defense has been very, very good. So I think the bottom line here, in the Pac-12 right now, as we sit here with two regular season games to go, the cream has now sort of risen to the top, right? Like Washington is in command and Oregon is in command, and they're both headed towards the Pac-12 championship game. The only team, look, there's all kinds of tiebreakers and crazy stuff does tend to happen in the Pac-12. The only team standing in the way of an Oregon-Washington rematch in Vegas is if Oregon State beats Washington. Real shame that College Game Day opted not to go to Corvallis this weekend. Yeah. That's the biggest game in the country. We can all talk about ESPN's relationship with the Pac-12, and they didn't want to deal with Oregon State fans, the Oregon State administration. So Game Day is going to James Madison, which is 10-0. But it doesn't look great that Game Day opted not to go to what should be the obvious Game Day game, Washington, Oregon State.
Yeah, James Madison is a worthy game to go to.
Yes.
I just think the optics of that make it look like ESPN was scared and they didn't want to address the elephant in the room. And
right.
It's unfortunate. Oregon State's, you know, they keep getting dumped on in a lot of different ways. Last year they got put on a lot of Pac-12 networks games and they weren't able to get seen on, you know, Fox or ABC or any of these other networks.
Right.
This year they've had a little bit better of an opportunity that way and clearly are at the top there. But they, you know, you got to feel for the Beavers. They've done everything right, and they're going to be left behind in a Pac-2 situation and really just kind of fending for their life, trying to figure out what to do. But look, Oregon State now is the team that can play spoiler, right? Washington and Oregon State play this week. Oregon State is favored by 1 point going into this game, so it's not like this is you know, a game where Washington should be tremendously favored. You know, Washington, if they win this game, they're automatically in the championship. So that's what's right at stake for them. Oregon State can muck it up a little bit. That's not to say they can't get in there, but they're playing the Utah card as of last year, right? If they beat Washington, that gives them a chance. And then if they go beat Oregon in the last game of the season, which we've never seen before, obviously that's never happened before.
Never happened, no. Especially not last year.
No. You know, no. That means Washington and or Oregon, depending on how that tiebreaker goes, if Washington loses another game, I still think Washington's in the game, but it's probably Washington and Oregon State. Arizona's still technically in the mix there. If they beat Utah this week, that definitely keeps them in the mix, but they still need like an Oregon State over Washington type result.
A considerable amount of help is what Arizona needs.
Arizona needs the Utah help last year. Oregon State is kind of on their own. They can actually win into the game. So it'll be interesting, but I don't think there's anything too crazy outside of that Washington-Oregon State game this week. And maybe we can talk a little bit more of those if we deem appropriate on our Thursday podcast, but I think that's probably about it. So as far as Pac-12 stuff goes, though, you know, it's been interesting, obviously, going into this season. There was a lot of talk about networks and wanting value in you know, TV markets and different things that way. The latest ratings came out for the games last week. Utah is the number two game last week. They got a 5.17 million people. The only game that beat them was Michigan Penn State at 9.16, right? Like that doing numbers.
Yeah.
But it's crazy. This is, to me, this is why Kyle Whittingham has been pushing for day games, right? And this is why the fact that Utah was able to have this season where they have their toughest schedule, where they have all these injuries, and the fact that they continue to get these, you know, national network games, Fox, they've been on Fox, I think, I could count it right now, but
at least twice.
They've been more than that. I think they got the USC, they got Oregon, Utah.
Yep.
UCLA was also a Fox game, so that's four games.
It's been a lot of broadcast games. Utah does not generally get that many broadcast games,
but it's helped, right? Like the fact that you got 5 million, and this is the games that they beat, right? The next closest game was Ole Miss Georgia, you know, two top 10 teams that were going after each other. Miami Florida State, which is all you can say what you want about Miami and where they're at right now,
that's a forever type of rivalry that people care about.
You used to have another top 25 game in Tennessee, Missouri, Michigan State, Ohio State. We get Michigan State and whatever, but Ohio State draws numbers. And USC, Oregon, they only just barely cracked the 3 million mark, but they were also at 8:30 p.m., you know, mountain time.
Right.
I think this is exactly what shows what playing in the afternoon does for a team like Utah, right? You're getting a lot of eyeballs. You've gotten a lot of people watching your games. Most of your games that have been on network TV have been at 3 million. You know, barring that Thursday night game against Florida as the season opener, where Florida had a lot of problems in Florida with their TV networks. I mean, these are some big games. So I don't know. Do you think that this gives any more credibility to what Kyle's been trying to preach? I know you and I have been preaching about wanting afternoon games or at least day games a lot. But do you think there is a substantive value to this and what Utah's getting out of this season?
Oh, I absolutely think that there is a substantive value for one playing in the middle of the day and not kicking off at, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock mountain time. Cause if you're, let's say you're recruiting kids, I'm making this up, you're recruiting kids in Texas and, or even Florida, which is on East Coast time. If you're recruiting kids in Florida, you're asking those kids to, and their parents and high school coaches to stay up until 9:30, 10 o'clock for kickoff.
Yeah.
Like it's just not a, you know, a tenable situation in terms of recruiting. It makes it tougher. The fact that it's on broadcast TV makes it easier for people to find it. I mean, I have Hulu, and even on Hulu, I know that I can find like NBC, Fox, ABC easier than I can ESPN, ESPN2, SEC Network. I can't find the Pac-12 Network at all because it's not on Hulu. So yeah, I mean, these are like real tangible things that Kyle, you know, is probably correct that they, you know, produce, you know, some tangible advantage, you know, playing during the day during quote real hours and playing on quote real networks and quote real TV. Like, yeah, those are tangible things that certainly have an effect. And yeah, I understand that fans want night games. And yes, the atmosphere at Rice-Eccles is tremendous at night, way, way better vibes at night. It's easier for a lot of people with children to get to a game at night. But from a football perspective, from a recruiting, from a Kyle Whittingham perspective, it's been a very good season in terms of kickoff times, making them earlier during the day on, you know, again, quote, real TV, not something like the Pac-12 network.
Stuart Mandel of The Athletic today tweeted, you know, imagine if the Pac-12 had waited 6 months to be able to get everything done. I mean, like Fox.
It's been a big season in the Pac-12, guys. Oh,
it has. I mean, and the thing is, Fox has been the one that was kind of out from the onset, right? Like ESPN was always kind of in the Pac-12 mix. And before that 50 million number was thrown out there, you know, they were easily going to re-sign to some extent. But Utah has been on Fox, like I said, four times. They've been on FS1. You know, outside of that, they've been on the Pac-12 network. They've been on the brightest stage that you can possibly be on. And that's, they're not the only ones, right? Colorado early on was on Fox every single week. You had Washington, you have Oregon, you have USC. All these teams have been there.
Big Noon kickoff went to Colorado, what?
4 weeks twice? In a row?
2 weeks in a row? Like, it's been a thing.
I mean, that's the crazy thing. You look at some of those numbers that Colorado had. They had a 10 million game. That's insane.
It's insane.
And so, like, I don't know. Like, it's sad if you go back and play the revisionist history of this. Like, what would happen if you waited 6 months to be able to sign it? There's not all this pressure to get the deal done before the season starts. I don't know that that changes anything, but it is pretty remarkable that what a season can do for you when you have good teams, right? Like, the Pac-12 was building to this. They finally get to it, and now it just becomes kind of the last chapter of a novel that we're all going to look back on and say, okay, that was fun, but look what could have been. So, look, I don't want to sit here and, you know, get too down on this moment and talk about how things have changed and, you know, everything about college football. But it is an interesting arc in the story of how this has gone and what's taken place. But I don't know. It is an interesting background to all that's gone on, and I'm curious to see how it moves forward. I mean, for Utah's sake, going to the Big 12, this isn't going to change. The Big 12 loves their day games. You know, this Utah still, I think we expect, especially if Cam Rising comes back, and, you know, I believe it's trending that way, that he's going to come back. I think this sets Utah up to be this kind of platform team again, right? Like, they get to be out there and potentially take a lot of these network games, and we'll see. But
I mean, in a vacuum, yes. But on the other side of that, I mean, I don't think that the Big 12 came this way to get Utah, BYU previously, sure, Colorado, the two Arizona schools. I don't think the Big 12 came this way so that they can be putting these schools on at 11 a.m.
Exactly. Noon. You're not
like, wrong. I think there's going to be a lot of night football once these schools are in the Big 12. There's going to be a lot of night football for Utah in the future. Again, the Big 12 did not come this way so they can shoehorn these schools into these early day kickoffs. It's going to be, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock, so that the networks can have Big 12 inventory deep into the evening. Now, of course, they're going to, you know, probably spread that around. And sure, there's going to be some day games, but I really think that the end game here for the Big 12 is, like, you came this way and got these schools so you can put them on during nighttime slots and bring your conference all the way to, you know, midnight, 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m. Eastern time. Like, that's the whole point.
Yeah, and I guess for me, I don't think this changes much going into the Big 12. Yeah, I would say the inventory is probably about the same in terms of wanting to have night games because, like you mentioned, moving west. But I would say if Utah stays at the top of the league, they're probably going to want to have some of those games. Colorado, you know, barring Dion actually leaving, they're going to be another draw because he's going to bring in even more recruits next year. You know, Arizona, if they continue to rise, I still don't know if Arizona is quite the household name yet. They've kind of been up and down for so long that it's been tough.
Football wise, you mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Basketball, completely different.
Yeah, no, they're not at that point just yet. You know, they haven't won a conference title. They haven't challenged for a conference title in a number of years. It's going to be interesting. I'll be curious to see kind of how all of the machinations work in terms of, you know, where Utah football ends up playing. Because again, you didn't come out this way for a noon kickoff, right? You came out this way so you can put them on in prime time. That's the whole point.
I just came to the Big 12 for Buc-ee's. That's really all I'm there for.
Thanks for twisting that knife. I didn't get my Buc-ee's during that Baylor trip.
You did not. And no, man, I'm sorry. I should have worn my Buc-ee's shirt today. One of these days.
One of these days.
All right. Well, let's switch over to the Utah game. We're 20 minutes in, and, you know, I think that's why people listen to us. I think. I don't know. Maybe they take us for their Pac-12 takes. You know, ratings talk. Maybe that should be our podcast now, ratings talk.
That's scary.
That is scary. I don't want to do that. I don't – I'm not the ratings guy, right? Like, I don't care. I think it's a data point as part of the season, but that's it. It's like this little tiny blip. Anyways, moving on. So Utah goes into Washington. You know, I think there was, you know, we talked about this in our preview article or, well, articles and this podcast. There was a lot of optimism going into this game, despite Washington being undefeated, being the number five team in the country. I think it just looked like Utah could match up with the Huskies in a much better way than they could against, say, a team like Oregon. So they get there, you know, they go up 28-24 at halftime. Everything is looking good. Utah's offense is dynamic. The defense is holding Michael Penix Jr. within reason, right? Like, he's still going to make his shots, and he did. Yep. But, like, there was several times where they were rushing him, and he's throwing bad passes, and he was doing different things that were making it tough. Even going into the third quarter, they hold Washington to a field goal. It's 28-27, and nothing happened for Utah. Everything changed. Utah couldn't do anything. Of their second half situation, they had five drives. Four of them ended in a three and out, and the other one ended in an interception slash fumble slash what the heck happened play that you obviously did a really good job recapping on Monday. I can't remember. Days are
they all meaningless anymore. They all mesh together. It's fine.
But this is the thing. Like, Utah was a completely different team in the first half. Second half, it was just nothing. Kyle Whittingham, you know, he's, I don't know. This is one of those times where he's playing a little too cute, we'll say, in the sense that he just says, I don't know what happened, right? Like, I've watched it several times and I don't know what happened. But at the same time, he also says that we didn't do anything well. We didn't pass well. We didn't run well. We didn't block well. We didn't. So, I mean, there's things like he's clearly going to that, but he's leaning far more into, he doesn't understand what happened. Where do you think that's coming, and why do you think he's saying that stuff?
Yeah, I'll take it a little bit deeper into the weeds. You know, I've said this before. Like, when I listen to Kyle Whittingham speak, sure, there is always some level of like misdirection when a head coach is dealing with the media. That's just part of the deal. But I really don't feel like I'm being lied to, straight lied to, right? Like when Kyle Whittingham speaks. So you had this game on Saturday, where it was, you know, the old cliche, right? A tale of two halves, right? Where the first half, right, the offense looked like so prolific and Bryson Barnes was taking shots down the field. And then the second half was the complete polar opposite, where, you know, it seemed like they stopped being aggressive and Washington made some adjustments and Utah did not have an answer for those adjustments. And the second half, I don't have the number in front of me. I believe it was 78 total yards of offense 76. In the second half. And, you know, we get to Monday and, you know, start asking Kyle Whittingham some questions. And this answer that he gave, and I'm going to read it because, Josh, you were good enough to transcribe this and put it on the script. Somebody on Monday asked Kyle about, you know, the difference between the two halves. And Kyle says, quote, in the second half, we didn't throw the ball as well. We didn't catch the ball as well. We didn't run the ball as well. We didn't run block as well. We didn't pass protect as well. It was two different outcomes in each half, end quote. And he goes on to say that he has no clue what the difference was between the two halves. How many hours in 19 seasons as a head football coach, how many hours of film do you think Kyle Whittingham has consumed in all that time?
Honestly, thousands. Billions.
Thousands.
Right? Yeah, billions.
He can watch. And again, I've said this and I'm going to say it again. I do not pretend to know every nuance of football. I don't. But you cannot tell me that if he says that he's watching this film three times, that you cannot come up with something that went wrong, something tangible that you can explain. Now, I'm going to go with he didn't want to throw anybody under the bus. Okay, that is not his MO. He doesn't want to throw the players under the bus. He never singles out players like that to throw them under the bus like that. So him saying that he has no idea, you know, what the problem was, there was a follow-up question to that. He doubled down on that. Later in that Monday press conference, I kind of asked it in a way where, you know, I essentially asked him, well, do you have a theory? Like, you've obviously met with your coaches. Do any of your, you know, 9, 10 position coaches, did anybody in the room have a theory about what went wrong. And he balked at that. So I found that whole exchange a little weird. But now that we're a day removed from that, like, I get it. You don't really want to make it, you know, you don't want to turn it into a thing. And I don't think Andy Ludwig had a great second half.
No.
In terms of play calling and putting guys in the right position. He just did not have a good second half. And there were some other things that just did not go well. And I'm sure that there was, you could pinpoint some decisions and maybe a position coach or two here and there. But the whole thing was weird. But again, a day, you know, removed. I understand it. Kyle is not one to publicly lambaste anybody, whether that be the officiating or the players or his position coaches. And he wasn't going to start on Monday. So it was weird. And maybe it was a little bit unnecessary. Like, I think we all could have used a little bit more transparency, but that was pretty weak to go down that route.
Well, and I, you know,
pretty weak.
I think for him, he's always either one where he's not going to give the full reason, or he's going to deflect and put it all on the coaching staff. This time he did really neither. He didn't do any of it, right?
And, but to completely balk like that, like, you completely, there were three questions in some form, three questions on this matter. Like, what changed between the two halves? You needed to give a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
And by the time you got to the follow-up, and by the time you got to the third question, you need to give a little bit more. And he didn't. And look, that's by design, because now it's Tuesday, and he will – what time is it? Yeah, it's Tuesday. He will talk late this afternoon with the beat writers for about 3 minutes. Then he will go on the radio show, his ESPN 700 in-house radio show, where he will say nothing about this.
Yeah.
And then the week is done for him. His week, media-wise, is done. He normally does maybe some radio stuff on Wednesday, some out-of-town media. He's done with this. So he got through Monday, and he'll do a little bit tonight. He won't answer anything. I doubt he'll even be asked about this. It'll be done for the week, and he can move forward. So now that I'm actually talking about this, it might actually be brilliant by him the way he did it. But to me, as a beat reporter and just somebody asking questions, somebody who's around, it all struck me as just a little unsavory and a little unnecessary that he would deflect it to that level that he did.
And I don't disagree with you, and I think it's smart on his way to be able to kind of deflect and move forward. But the problem is you're starting to see a little schism jump in the way with the players. And look, players are always going to disagree with coaches. So I don't want to sit here and paint a picture that, like, there's a lot of unhappiness. Like, this happens every single season, even in undefeated seasons, right?
Always.
But I think that there's a little bit different. And you know, if you've seen on Twitter the Devon Vele quote about right after the game, he was asked what happened and he wants to know as well. I mean, that's kind of, he jumped into it and he says, I want to know as well. We were doing up tempo. We were doing all these different things. Yep. You know, he's frustrated as well. Yesterday, we talked to Jaquinnon Jackson and Bryson Barnes. You know, I asked him pointedly, like, what happened in that second half? And his body language said more than what he actually said, because at the end of the day, he didn't say anything. He said, I don't really want to talk about it. But he paused several times and just said, man, like, and he just kind of kept trying to find the right words and then just said,
who said that?
Yes.
Josh?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then he just said, I just don't want to talk about it. But, like, he kept trying to come back to it. Like, you could tell he was so frustrated by what happened. And look, he can point to that safety that was put on him. That's not his call. That's a terrible call. They should have done something like a play action call. Even I, as a stupid football person, like, no, like, probably there's a better call there than lining up in shotgun and giving him 6 yards back and letting him try to get out of the end zone.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's things there, right? Whether he's frustrated with Andy Ludwig or he's frustrated with Kyle, I don't really know. I don't honestly really care. I think that is where it comes, though, where if the players are frustrated and they're not believing in what's being said, that makes it really difficult, right? Bryson Barnes came out and said, I just run the plays that Andy Ludwig calls. Like, to me, like, what are they supposed to say? But at the same time, they're saying everything with those types of things, right? They were frustrated with how that second half went. Now, with that being said, the major caveat is Utah did nothing with the plays that they had, right? Like, right. I have it on here on our little rundown, and I'm not going to go over every single drive, but of those five drives that they had in the second half, I mentioned three of those were three and out. Many of them were a 2-yard pass, a 1-yard keeper, a 6-yard rush. Some of them were derailed by penalties, the offensive pass interference at Sugaturaga that we could talk about if we want to later. There's holding penalties. There's a lot of mistakes there, right? So as much as you want to criticize Andy Ludwig, and I think there's a lot that you can criticize him for, this also comes to the players, right? Like, things didn't happen. There was incomplete passes. Only one of them was a pass breakup by Washington. Things happen, right? Like, I think just everything kind of combined in the same vein to make it so that Utah couldn't do what they needed to. And that's why Kyle is probably going a little bit more to that, because everything was wrong, right? Like, everything just didn't work.
Yeah. You know, you start, and again, we're not going to break down like every last drive, but like, you know, when I sit down on Saturday night to write the Sunday story, I do try to go through like the drive chart and, you know, kind of highlight like things that didn't go wrong. There were, let me think here. Spencer Fano had a tough day at left tackle. Spencer Fano in the third, when was the fumble interception safety? That was the
End of the third quarter. Yep.
End of the third quarter. So in that third quarter, he had a crusher holding penalty that backed them up. And then after the interception slash fumble with Utah pinned on the one, as you said, like, we can like talk about Ludwig going, you know, out of the gun with a running play. No matter what that play call was, Spencer Fano got blown up on that play. And that play never had a chance. It could have been anything called. That play never had a chance. Yeah. And look, he's been, you know, you need to be very optimistic about the player that Spencer Fano could be. But, and he's been good this season, but there have been moments where he looks like a freshman.
Yeah.
And he looks a little overwhelmed by the moment. Moments of that third quarter were reminders of just how young Spencer Fano is. So, you know, you had that. The Sugaturaga offensive pass interference, I've watched that 25 times. Objectively, I just don't see it. So that killed a drive. And Kyle Whittingham, man. Kyle Whittingham in the post-game press conference, I think it was you who asked about the Sugaturaga offensive pass interference. And, you know, classic Kyle, like, he's not going to talk about something until he decides to talk about something. And I'm paraphrasing his answer, but he was like, you know, the officials got their money's worth. Which is, you know, that's not nothing. Like, that's definitely something tangible that he said. You know, the officials got their money's worth. Something like 19 total penalties for almost 200 yards. And then at the end of that quote, he's like, I have no comments on that.
That's
like,
my favorite part. Said everything.
What do you mean?
That was my favorite.
So, just, you know, a lot of moments. Like, I don't think they played – they didn't play a super clean game, but I didn't think it was sloppy enough where they didn't have chances late. I thought Washington late in that game, up seven, they did a really nice job of leaning on Utah and bleeding that clock down. Field goal gets blocked. You know, you give it back to Bryson Barnes with, you know, with a chance to drive down the field to tie or even win that game. If you, you know, hit the TD and go for two, it was, I don't even remember at this point. It was incomplete, something. And then the fourth down pass was a blitz, and he's running for his life. And he, you know, he threw it up there in desperation. It gets picked off. Like, this is not one of those games where you're going to lament the fact that, like, oh, like, we should have had that. Like, we had enough opportunities. I thought you got completely outplayed in the second half.
Yep.
And, you know, your opportunities were kind of buried under the fact that, like, you just got outplayed. Like, Washington played a much better second half. And even in the first half, when Barnes was throwing it all over the place, Washington was still doing enough to keep contact. It's not like Utah was up, like, 28-7 at the half. Like, Michael Penix was, you know, doing enough. And Roma Dunze was getting one-on-one looks way too many times. How many one-on-one catches did Roma Dunze have? He had three catches on the day. Two of them went for scores. I think all three of those were on one-on-one coverage.
Yep, they were.
And I think he had seven targets for the day. At least five of those, he got a guy one-on-one. So Washington did enough to win this game. It's not that Utah coughed this up. It's not that Utah blew this. It's that they got outplayed by Washington throughout the second half.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think it's a difficult thing to look at, because we can go back and look at, we can point at, oh, they had 4 3 and outs and different things that way. But that whole game changes. on that one drive where they get to the 14-yard line, right? The two previous were three and outs. Even the second one you can live with because the drive ended on a pass breakup. Washington just did the best thing on third down, forced them to do it, right? You can live with that. Then Utah goes in there, and they have this great drive, 14-yard rush, holding penalty on Fano, 10-yard rush, 11-yard rush, 4-yard pass, pass incomplete, roughing the passer on Washington. Then Sugaturaga gets a holding penalty, and then that turns into the interception, fumble, recovered, all that other stuff. But Utah's on the 14-yard line, right? Before that holding penalty on Sugaturaga, they're right there. I think everybody in the stadium felt like, okay, Utah's back. This is like, it was a tit for tat type situation all game, and Utah was just going to go right back. Washington couldn't do anything. They got a field goal. You know, they couldn't even take the lead. Now Utah's going to go extend its lead. This is where it's at. That changed the entire tenor of the game, right? All of a sudden, that changed it. It took the wind out of their sails. It took everything. And then Utah was playing from behind, right? Even though it was just a 7-point game, I think that mixed with the safety just absolutely became a demoralizing moment for Utah. It's hard to come back from that, especially when you don't agree with the play call and the safety. That changed everything for them, right? And I don't want to put the whole game on that, but that's kind of where it was, right? They didn't have a lot of opportunities because Washington took the ball. They drilled the clock down as low as they could, and if not for that blocked field goal, like, Utah really didn't have anything going their way because they couldn't do anything. And so, like, you can be frustrated by the tell of two halves, and it absolutely was. Anybody that watched that game understands it, but football especially is a momentum game, right? Basketball, you can get through some momentum shifts, and it's felt, but it's not really the same within, like, big major moments. Football, there's just limited plays, right? And if a team takes the game, you know, ahead by getting the touchdown and then you get the safety, then you drain the clock, like, it just becomes a much more difficult, more demoralizing game, and I think that's where Utah's at. So as much as you want to be frustrated about this game, and I don't want to sit here and play the moral victory card because I don't think Utah's at that stage, and it's
they're past that.
Yeah, like, no. That's not what this is. But I think, you know, you can look at this game with a little bit better light in the sense that Utah just, they got played out, right? Like, Oregon can look back at the exact same thing with Washington and say, at the end of the day, Washington came out on top because they did one more thing than we did, and that's how it changed. Yeah. So at the end of the day, you want to be in these competitive games. You're at week 11, 10th game of the season. Mm-hmm. Utah was playing for a Pac-12 championship game. Sure, everything had to go their way still, but you were still competitive for that. You know, you're in an opportunity where you're doing well with your reserve players. I mean, I look at that offensive roster. Every week, Jordy sends the email, said, who do you want to talk to this week? And I'm speechless, honestly. Like, I have no idea who I'm going to talk to this week.
I want to talk to Rising.
I do.
But, and we can rant about that later. That's more of a media inside baseball thing. But anyway, go on.
But no, but that's just the point, right? Like, we're to a point where we're talking to guys, either some that just don't like to talk as much. Like, Jaquindon Jackson just doesn't like to talk, and I don't blame him. You know,
but he understands that there's a bit of a responsibility there to step in front of the mic.
But, like, there's just, like, outside of an offensive line that really has been, for the most part, healthy this year, everybody has been dinged up and hurt, and you don't want to keep talking to Devon Vele, and you don't want to keep talking to, I mean, Bryson's going to be the face of the team, and so you're going to talk to him. But, like, this is where we're at now, where there's just so many players down. And, look, I'm not using this to make an excuse about where Utah's at. I'm just saying, like, this is where it's at, where you're trying to piecemeal these things together, and, like, it just makes it difficult for us. It makes it difficult for them. Kyle called it his most difficult coaching job that he's ever had. I'm thinking he's speaking more towards the injuries, not towards, like, the Aaron and Ty. I think if he looked back and said that in totality, those two seasons were clearly the hardest based on
that's a different thing.
So don't mix
altogether.
Those up. Yeah. But no. I think just in the totality of, like, what it means to be a football coach, this has been his toughest season. So take that all with, like, some background there.
Everything that you just said, again, everything needs context. They can still win 10 games.
Yeah, exactly.
If they beat Arizona, they beat Colorado, whoever they play in, whatever bowl they play in, it's not what you want, right? Because the goal now, and I've said this 1,000 times when I was at the Trib and now at KSL, the reasonable, rational goal is to win the Pac-12, but everything needs context with the amount of injuries and the amount of nonsense and the way that September went with Rising and the quarterback situation and the offense was anemic, the fact that they are still, you know, capable of winning 9 regular season games, a 10th game at a bowl, is remarkable. And look, this will not go down as, you know, this will not go down as Kyle Whittingham's best coaching job, right? You know, there is no postseason. There is no Pac-12 championship game. You know, you can't put it above, you know, what he did in 21 and 22. But like, when you really like take a step back and you consider all of the issues and all of the nonsense, and, you know, scoring, you know, the offense scored 7 points against UCLA, and they, you know, they needed to come back against Baylor. When you like take all of it in totality, this is a pretty remarkable position that they're in, not to go to the Pac-12 championship game, but to put together a 9-win season, a 10-win season. And you said this earlier, if you had told a Utah fan that like Rising would not play a snap and Keithy would not play a snap and, you know, Logan Fauna would be out for the year and Lander Barton would be out for the year and Jaquindon Jackson would be banged up and, you know, and A, B, and all of these things. If you had said, hey, we're still going to win 9 games, I think a lot of irrational people would be like, no, like we need to be going to the Pac-12 championship game. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I think a lot of people would sign up for 9 wins, potentially 10 wins, based on everything that has gone on here, which is a lot.
It's funny because after that Oregon State game, I mean, I just think the vibe around the team was just broken, right? The offense was broken. They didn't have anything. I went on ESPN 700. I think it was on Spence's show. It might have been on Bill's show. And they asked, you know, the win total for the season was 8 wins. Do you take the over or under at this point? And I absolutely took the under. I said it's still possible to take the over because, you know, it is possible. But, like, the way the team was playing and the way the offense was playing, there was no way. Like, Utah might have gotten to that 8-win mark, but it didn't feel like this was anywhere near that, especially with Washington, Oregon, USC, all those games still on the docket. Like, that was insane. And so, like, once again, like, I'm not here to, like, you know, hype you up and say, okay, like, good job, pat you on the back type
thing.
I'm
not trying to rah-rah here. No. I'm just trying to keep it real.
But I think you do have to look back in that, right? Like, you have to look back in the totality of the season. You have 11 Power 5 games, and the fact that you can go potentially to a 10-win season with a bowl game, the fact that you can get that, that's a remarkable thing. It shows what Kyle's been able to build. Despite all of the frustrations and all of the different things that has gone on to the season, he continues to maintain and he finds different ways to do it. So, yes, this is not his best season ever. I think if Utah maybe had gotten to the Pac-12 championship, you could potentially talk about this being his best coaching effort ever. But, look, it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, you've got a great coach. You've got a guy that understands what he needs to do to be able to get his team in a position, even if you're getting second, third string guys on. I think that's remarkable. So celebrate that for what that's worth.
Yeah, and you know, to that, and we can move on after this, I'll just add that after Oregon State, which was a low point, right, you had the bye, and then they were hosting Cal.
Yeah.
And at that point, I wrote, you know, the Cal game coming off the bye, the way they lost to Oregon State, that Cal game was going to be a referendum on what the rest of the season could be. And they showed up against Cal. They played really well against Cal, and then they played really well against USC, and they, you know, they kept showing up. And that was the point I was trying to make. That Cal game was going to set a tone for what you want this season to be. And it's not what anybody has wanted it to be because of the injuries, but again, everything needs context. And look, the 3 losses, you've lost to 3 top 10 teams, and you've lost to, in my humble opinion, the 3 best teams in the conference.
Yep.
You know, you got blown out by Oregon, fine. Washington, Oregon State, which, you know, you and I agree in a different scenario, if everybody was healthy, if they had at least had the quarterback situation straightened out, maybe you win that Oregon State game.
Agreed.
And the season is a little bit different now. Like, maybe you're 8-2 needing help to get to the Pac-12 championship game, but I'm going off on a tangent here. Just everything needs context. And this season has, well, maybe it has been a train wreck, and in some ways it has been a train wreck, but it is not the like utter embarrassment, disappointed, fire everybody type of season that some people in my direct messages want to paint it as. It's not the complete embarrassment that some people want to paint it as.
And I'm gonna say this might have actually been very beneficial to Utah, knowing what could potentially come back next year. You had guys that were looking to go to the NFL this year that were using this season as a way to be able to jumpstart their NFL career or kind of move forward that way, this season didn't work out in a way that I think really helped a lot of guys put tape out there. Now, that's not to say that it didn't for everybody, but I think enough that it could, and look, we still have a couple games left, but I think it could be a way where you bring a few guys back that they say, look, I want to do it one more time. I want to be able to show out well in the Big 12. I want to be able to do this with everybody full strength and see what happens. Now, with that said, there's still guys, you know, Cole Bishop, for example, Sione Vaki. I know he's only a sophomore technically, but he's technically of the age that he can and leave. That, you know, I think they can explore that opportunity, but we're going to see. And I don't think as many as I was expecting are going to leave just based off of that. This is where you're going to say no.
What's up?
I said, this is where you're going to say nah.
No. I'm like, I could feel the wheels turning in my head. No, I probably agree that less guys feel inclined to leave based on how the season has gone. But remember, Devon Vaile had one foot out the door last year, and the number one factor there was his age. Okay, he was 24 as a fourth-year sophomore. He's 25 now. He knows time is not on his side in terms of getting a legit shot at the NFL. This is going to be a fascinating offseason. Every offseason is a little bit fascinating as guys make their decisions, but this one is even more fascinating because you're going to a conference now where if all of the key characters come back, I don't know that like you're installed as the preseason favorite in the Big 12 in year one, but you're certainly like thinking that you can do that. Like if Rising comes back, if Keithy comes back, if you get some combination of Devon Vaile, Money Parks, Jaquindon Jack, if the key guys come back, you're going to be right in the mix for a conference title straight out of the gate. But, and I made this point on Twitter yesterday, a lot of these guys are still working on a COVID timeline.
Yeah.
Okay. They're in year four, year five of college with 1 year, 2 years to play. Not everybody wants to be in school for another year. So there's a lot of factors. Do you want to still be in school? What does the NIL situation look like here and elsewhere? We can get into that later. Cole Bishop is an interesting one. Like Cole Bishop is probably a day two NFL draft pick right now. If he leaves, like that seems to be the consensus. If you come back for one more run, do you sneak into the first round? So a lot of questions here to come, and we're just not getting any answers until after the regular season, at least.
And this leads to a point that Kyle talked about on Monday about how in the past they used to be able to wait until the regular season was over to be able to talk about the transfer portal or talking about the future with the NFL careers as guys start looking at what their potential value is from the scouts and stuff like that. They get a grade and kind of see how this works if they want. Right. But now he's had to move that up immediately. And he's had to probably move that up even quicker now that the coaching carousel changes. And there's a weird, I don't want to say weird, it's a new rule in the NCAA where if a coach is fired before the season ends, a 30-day transfer window opens up. And so anybody on that team can declare themselves to be in the transfer portal. They can be picked up by another team during that time as well. So you could have, in theory, somebody on, say, Texas A&M enter the transfer portal, you know, earlier this week, and there were a handful that already did. Utah could, in theory, then pick up that player before the season's even over. So, like, that opens up a 30-day transfer portal period, but then also December opens up that transfer portal period. So you've got two of these periods where guys are going to leave Utah, guys either that don't feel like they're getting enough playing time or they want a different experience or whatever that may be. You've got guys looking for an NFL career. You've got guys that may just honestly don't know what they want to do. This is where Kyle is now having to talk to them a little bit earlier, and he said that he has. Those conversations have begun. And on Twitter, it kind of got mixed responses. Some people were like frustrated by it, like, oh, great, now we're going to lose all these players. I don't think that's what he's meaning.
People were confused on Twitter?
No, that never happens. It's weird.
Sorry, go on.
No, you're good. I think it's just funny to me that it's like, look, he's having conversation. That's literally all it is. It's not meant to be like I'm pushing people out. The reality is coaches do push players out. So, like, that's what it is.
What do you mean?
And people want to have these players as employees. That's only going to get worse for them, honestly. Like, I don't think it's going to help them. Maybe it gives you a strengthening union, even though the union is going to be weak because there's literally nobody to enforce it. I digress. But I think this is where it's at, right? Like, all it is Kyle is having conversations. The position coaches are having conversations, and they're looking to their future. I asked JJ about it, actually, and he declined to comment. I figured he would. He's not going to get into it. But we're getting to that point of the season where we're going to start asking these players what their future is. And they're still going to, you know, they're going to balk a little bit. Some of them are a little bit more, you can kind of tell. Like, the Devon Vele one was a real one last year where he was teetering back and forth. But you're going to start hearing that.
I'm sorry. Let me just cut you off. He was not teetering. He was
out the door. He was 100%.
Mid-November, he was out the door. And then, like, before the Rose Bowl, like early December, mid-December, that had changed. But he was him and Rising were leaving.
Oh, yeah. I think you and I, you and I were the ones that somehow lucked into where we could talk to them one-on-one, not one-on-ones, two-on-one, I guess. And they actually were pretty honest with us, right? Like, you don't get a lot of especially late in the season, but they were pretty honest with us. I mean, Devon, for all intents and purposes, said, like, he was out the door, right? Like, I think fact that he came back was surprising. He seemed happy by the decision, but I mean, it was more, you know, it was a little shocking, to say the least. So
it was, yeah. And I'm sure, look, NIL has a part in that. Vele needing more film, that surely played a role. But yeah, he was, I'm going to look that up just to have a refresher. But like, I remember writing that before the Oregon game last year. So we're talking like mid November. He was pretty, he didn't say like I'm leaving, but he made it very, very clear that his college career was over. And then that all changed. And I'm sure a lot of that had to do with Rising as well. Look, if you want to get more film, if you think you need more film, like, what better way to do that than with your veteran quarterback who you already have a rapport with? I think, look, now that we're here, I mean, I think, you know, within all these player decisions and like what's going to happen, I wonder if Rising hits the portal.
Don't rule it out.
There's definitely some back channel. Let's just, all right, I'm not going to tiptoe around this. There's some back channel recruiting. Let's just stop. Okay. Like, this is what it is. Yeah. There is back channel recruiting happening, at least kicking the tires, gauging interest in some of these guys. There's going to be interest in Rising. He's going to be, what, 18 months removed from, you know, from knee surgery, but when he's healthy, he's a hell of a quarterback.
Yes.
And he can help a Power Five team. So I wonder, like, that's an option. Like, Rising leaving Utah, I'm not saying that's imminent. Please don't quote me on Ute Zone and like, please don't do that. Okay. But like, Rising taking the medical red shirt and leaving Utah is a real legitimate option.
It is. And I will say, I think the general vibe is he's committed to Utah as long as Utah stays committed to him, if that makes sense, right? Like, I think if the NIL number works, and I don't think he's going to try to get max value. I think he can, and I think Utah's going to give him as much as they possibly can. He's still going to get people that are going to pay him more at other schools.
Yes.
But I think as long as the two parties stay committed to each other and there is an equal agreement, I think Utah still is the odds-on favorite. I know that sounds crazy because he is at Utah, but I think the way that he's remained engaged has helped. I think that helps where Utah's at. But at the same time, don't at all be surprised, right? Like, I think what you said, like, there are some real teams out there that are trying really hard to get Rising. Money is obviously going to be something that's going to be on the table. The real question is going to come down to, does he feel like he can go into a new system and be able to replicate what he does in 1 year, right? He's not given a lot of time. If he is going to do
all
this
knee surgery, exactly. He hasn't been hit in a long time.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's got to kind of take all this into whatever he has to decide. Mm-hmm. I still think Utah is probably his best option. I mean, it makes the most sense. He understands the system. He's been there. He knows the guys. So I think Utah has the upper hand just simply because of all that. But don't rule it out. You know, like you said, don't use this as a scare tactic necessarily, but that's the nature of it, right? A coveted quarterback like himself, who probably isn't going to have an NFL future, as we've talked about, is still a phenomenal college quarterback. And if you can dominate, and maybe you can do that at some of the top-end school where you're going to compete for a national championship, that's going to be a real factor. You're going to look into that, and you're going to want to be able to play into that.
Whether or not, if Rising returns to Utah, or if he leaves and then they have to go into the portal looking for somebody. This whole thing strikes me as a litmus test for the Crimson Collective,
yeah,
to see if it can get things done and how much juice there really is. I don't know that anybody's asked Kyle Whittingham this question. Maybe we should. I'm sure Kyle is well aware of what the market value is of a Power 5 level quarterback with Rising's experience.
Yeah.
No matter what happens here, if he returns, look, if he returns, he's coming back with a number. This is where we are. He's getting paid something collectively from the NIL deals through the collective. He is coming back for a number. Whether it's Rising coming back or you have to go find somebody else and pay that person, we're going to find out how much juice this, you know, fledgling, budding Crimson Collective has, right? It took the Crimson Collective, it took the NIL machine here at Utah a little while longer to get cranked up, right? Like, certainly more than Mark Harlan would have wanted, absolutely longer than Kyle Whittingham would have wanted. Harlan specifically was going to keep things buttoned up and not turn his athletic department into the Wild West. So over the spring, you know, late April, here comes the Crimson Collective. I really don't want to say the wrong thing here. This is the, like, the initial litmus test. Can you hang on to Rising for X number? And if you have to go get somebody else, can you come up with enough to get somebody viable who can lead you into the Big 12 and have you contending immediately?
And if you believe the reports of what it takes to get a top end quarterback, it's probably around $1.5 to $2 million. And that's probably a starting value for some of these guys.
I don't think Rising is at the top of the top tier, though.
No. And so I think you at least have a benchmark between probably somewhere $1 million to $2 million. That's probably where Rising is going to land. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean he's going to take that. But I think, like you mentioned, the Crimson Collective is going to have to be in that ballpark. We've mentioned this several times. Their goal was to get to $5 million by the beginning of December. They obviously have other players that they've got to keep. They've got to keep somebody like a Jaquindon. They've got to try to keep somebody like Sione, unless these guys are going to the NFL. Like, you've got a lot of players that you have to manage, and there has to be kind of like a general manager of sorts that does that, and the collective kind of gets involved, and it's a weird relationship where they can be involved, but they can't, and so it becomes tricky, right?
You're not completely married. Let's call them roommates.
Sure,
not,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes it tricky based on the NCAA rules. You also can't technically tie it to pay for play, and so there has to be some things around
let's
it.
Let's get real. Come on,
I know. Like, we're dancing around this, and nobody's...
That's not going to happen here, straight pay for play, but, like, let's...
No.
There's a lot of pay for play happening.
I would argue, though, that the pay for play thing might tie into Cam a little bit more, just based on his knee situation. You play on the field, or we don't pay you. I know they can't do that, but that would be, in my opinion, where the pay for play could absolutely get involved with Utah. Right?
I've gotten that from a few people, just not like the people asking, like, well, is the NIL deal, whatever the NIL looks like for Rising, is that going to be affected by the fact that he got paid this year, but didn't play it down? I don't have an answer for that. I don't know, like the strict inner workings of that. I think that's an interesting notion. I'd be curious to hear more about that, but I thought that was interesting.
It might make people a little more cautious as they're making deals, but I don't think it's going to steer them away. I think you saw Rising's value, and if there's even a glimmer of hope that he's playing, and why would he come back and not play? Like, that's stupid, right? Like, let's be real. If he's coming back, the money is going to be there. Utah's going to be fine. I think that's not the issue. So, I don't know. Take that all into account. Obviously, we've got two more games left in the season. We're going to get into this a lot more. Maybe we get into a little more of the inner workings of the Crimson Collective. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot there, and it's still the wild, wild west. But that's just where it's going to be, right? Like, Utah is going to have to fend off a lot of these schools, and they have to hope that their quote-unquote culture is strong enough that you can fend off some of these guys and keep them. It worked for Dalton Kincaid, and obviously you saw how that worked out. That doesn't mean it's going to happen for everybody.
People want
generational wealth, right? Like, even $1 million is a lot of money. And not that all these players are going to, you know, target that kind of money, but the point being, if you know that you can get a lot of money and you know you can be in maybe a potential better situation, why aren't you not going to take that? Like, that's just where it's at.
You know, and we sort of went off the rails here talking about this, but, like, this is what is coming this offseason.
Yeah.
Guys, like, this, you know, decisions to be made by Rising and others. And look, this is this is very weird to be talking about in terms of like money, essentially free agency. Like, I've been doing this long enough to remember where the off season, it was really quiet.
Yeah.
Like, I remember covering college football seasons in like 2013, 2014, like before the portal, before NIL, and like a season would end. And like, yes, of course there's news, like guys are transferring, you have to deal with that. But like, it was a true off season. Like, football ended on a Saturday. I'm at basketball practice on Monday and I am not thinking about football at all. Not the case. Like, Utah is going to play Colorado and there's going to be bowl prep, but like, there are like 19 things to deal with, like the second the Colorado game ends. So just, you know, sort of interesting slash depressing how long I've been doing this, that you can see like the radical drastic differences kind of in the landscape of like what covering college football used to be and what it is now.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
With that, I think we've hit our time. I think we can touch up on more stuff on Thursday as we preview Arizona. But you know, I think there's a lot that's going on with this Utah team, even though they're not in contention for the Pac-12 championship. There's a lot going on, so we'll continue to monitor that and continue to do what we do. But yeah, thanks for listening to us. We appreciate all the times that you've let us talk to you. I know we're probably gone downhill. Let's be real.
Have we though?
I think we'd hit our peak, honestly.
I feel like we're putting out a product. I mean, if the numbers say otherwise, tell me.
No, I think it's great. So look, keep listening. If you want to keep, you know, listening to us, that's great, because that helps us and we can be able to give out some stuff that helps us kind of give more than just what we do it right. So
we're nice guys.
We are. Hey, yeah, whatever. We appreciate it. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll catch you again later.
Later, guys.